thought of it architecturally. It was my church, and it's always been my church. It gives me infinitely more than I can give it.
My point of view, it's a catch question, is it? I've always, it is my church, and, but it is uncommon, yes.
You do get very attached to it, I find. And you go in and it's just like home, really. I really love it. And because it stops the world for me, it's, I think, the best thing around.
Elsha King, Godfrey Gillett and Margaret Huffner describing their feelings for the Church of St Peter and St Paul, Albury, a most surprising building to look at, but one which inspires great affection in people who know and love it. Most visitors, seeing this large red brick church for the first time, experience the same jumble of emotions that Henry Drummond, Lord of the Manor, must have felt on his return from abroad in 1842 to inspect the new church he'd commissioned. It was radically different from the stone church he'd admired so much in Normandy and which he'd ordered an accurate copy of. But once the visitor steps inside, disappointment turns to delight. Passing through the vestry, as I am now, you enter a lofty and beautiful temple, astonishingly large for a village church. And yet, many times in its history, Albury Church has needed every inch of this space. As Wynne Brown and Margaret Tupper recall, it has sometimes fairly bulged with worshippers, and among them were some very influential members of the congregation indeed.
I used to go to church. I go to Farley Green Church now because I'm taken there. But I used to go to Albury, the parish church, very regularly. But the congregations were pretty large then. And I remember when the people were in residence at the park, it seemed quite an occasion when they all came into church and sat in the front seat. Mm. It was really quite something.
This is when the Duchess...
The Duchess and the Duke too, the one who died in 1929, I remember him, of course.
At Matins one morning, the first time I went to church in the morning, I stood up to go out of the church, because probably I had some lunch to cook or something, and I thought I'd get out quickly at the back. Somebody pulled me down again. We all had to sit until the Duchess and her entourage had come down the aisle. It was the formality of it, all the calling and the cards that had to be turned up at the corner and things you could do and couldn't do. It was... That was a great shock to me.
Margaret Tupper, as a young curate's wife, newly arrived in Albury, remembering her first social gaffe. Wynne Brown also remembers a very poignant occasion for the village and the Northumberland family.
One of the services I remember was the Duke of Northumberland's memorial service in 1940. He was killed in May 1940, killed in action. And the Reverend Philip Gray was the rector then, and he took the service. There were a lot of people, of course, at the church, because there were a lot of estate workers in those days, and a lot of village people who'd known him, I expect, a long time. And one of the things I remember vividly about the service was the rector read an extract from one of his last letters to his mother, the Duchess of Northumberland, in which, it's a long time ago, but I think this was more or less the lines of it, that he was writing the letter in a woods, which had beech and silver birch and bluebells, and reminded him very much of Albury.
A sad moment in Albury's history. Kathleen Merritt was an enthralled spectator when an even greater celebrity visited the church, a much-loved royal.
Someone said one Sunday, Queen Mary's coming this afternoon to the church, you see. And I said, oh, yes, she's coming to see the tapestry, that one at the end, you see. So I said, oh, come on, Tim. So we went and we sat on the memorial down there. And we saw this grand car come along and sweep up. And so we waited till she came down again. And I think she must have either been visiting Helen, Duchess of Northumberland, or was going there afterwards. She wasn't here terribly long. But she waved graciously as we were sitting on the memorial. That was all we ever saw of her.
No doubt about it, Albury's church was a busy place. Wynne Brown told me that not only were the congregations large in those days, so was the choir, and Godfrey Gillett was one of the choristers.
When I first came to Albury, there were a lot of men, choir, young men, and lots of boys. I think there were about a dozen. And but I think that was general to most village churches then. Girls were rather frowned upon, but there was a very good choir there.
When I was eight, or thereabouts, I may have been a little under. I joined the choir, and there was quite a lot of members in the choir, mainly boys at that time, and as much we filled the whole, I think there was room for eight boys each side in the chancel at Albury Church, and I think we overflowed a bit. In any case, when the sermon was on, two or three of us were allowed to go and sit just behind to give those a bit more room. Even then, we got chastised from time to time for chattering and that during the sermon and upsetting everybody in general, but I suppose boys will be boys. My first recollection, which I aim not to forget, is that in 1928 still, it was the introduction of the electricity to the church. And at that time I was the youngest boy, and as that boy I switched it on during the dedication service one Sunday morning, the 11 o'clock service matins. And when Canon Skene was rector at that time.
What an honour.
Yes, I think so, yes, yes. I was very proud of that.
Godfrey Gillett performing an early duty for Albury Church. Those packed choir stalls held a special attraction for Elsha King.
The boy that I married was in the choir, so I have a rather strong feeling that one of my earliest interests in church was the boy that I was looking at in the choir. Oh, Reg used to sit right at the end where I could see him very well and he could see me. Oh, yes, we had a very good, we had a good contact that way.
And do you recollect that regular Sunday visit and
the, oh, yes,
the formality of the service and the sermons and the rest of it?
I wasn't interested in the sermons, I was interested in Reg.
Elsha King. In later years, the choir and the rector, in their sparkling cassocks and surplices, had Kathleen Merritt to thank for looking so spick and span. Kathleen had been a member of the choir herself, and one day she had a word in the ear of the Reverend Stuart Orme, the rector at that time.
I said to him, your surplice looks rather grey. So he said, oh, does it, Mrs. Merritt? I said, yes. So he said, why, should it look better? I said, well, I'm sure it ought to look whiter than that. So he said, well, would you wash them? And I said, well, yes, certainly. So I took on, I said, I do the altar cloths, you see. And when my children were in the choir, I always did their little surplices and also any others that I saw that was looking, that were looking rather sort of grubby, I think, or take those home and wash them. And so he said, oh, all right. So I used to do his surplice and his big alb. This is the very large one they wear for communion. But it's a frightful thing to iron because it's like a small tent. But I used to soak them and wash them and boil them. And they used to look beautifully white. But I used to feel quite proud when I saw him walking in and looking so sort of blue-white, new dads and all that sort of thing, you know. Absolutely lovely.
Bye.
the organist we had then, he was very good. He was here, oh, must be about 26, 27 years, Mr. Rowland. He was devoted to the church. The church and his music here came first with everything. And he really, as I say, several of us, the only musical knowledge we have is what we gained through him. He was extremely patient, and he would always explain everything to you. He'd play all the notes, and usually he could tell you some funny little anecdote about whichever composer it was, you know. And we were very good, because several times we went into the cathedral and did an evensong when the cathedral choir were away on holiday.
He put on some very nice musical evenings. We had soloists in from outside, and we formed the chorus, you know, like the Crucifixion and things of that nature he put on. And very enjoyable they were. I enjoyed them enormously.
Wynne Brown and Kathleen Merritt remembering Mr. Rowland, an inspirational organist and choirmaster. Godfrey Gillett can tell you about an earlier organist, Mr. Bailey, and the complications of playing an earlier organ.
During the service, I often recall it must have been very difficult to control anything, because bearing in mind where the organ used to be in the south transept above the rector's vestry, all he had was a mirror, like you had in your motor car, to see what was going on down below, which of course trying to play the organ at the same time.
So that produced the odd discordant moment, did it, when he thought it was time to play the next hymn? And
Yes, he managed very well. I had a lot of time for him, really, because then we had the organ replaced by Miss Capados, who lived in Church Lane. I hope I'm right, I think it cost £2,000, and in 1935 that was a lot of money. And we have this beautiful John Compton organ now, and as a matter of fact, I did play it once. The choir master at that time, as I said, Mr. Bailey, he selected the stops, obviously, because it's a very complicated instrument to play, but a very fine instrument.
There was a very strong mother's union here at the time, and I, just married, no children, went to a service. The organist was a good-looking young man, unmarried, and the rest of the congregation, I think, were middle-aged, elderly. And Mr. Gray, in his sermon, said, "Now we mothers know what it's like." And the organist and I caught one another's eye. That was funny.
Yes. The late 1930s and the early 1940s were, of course, wartime years. Gerard Sherman, a long-time church warden, told me about two special services here at the church, one before and one after the Second World War.
The only recollection I have is of the time of Munich. There was a service praying for peace, and I remember everyone came, and I suppose it was just after Harvest Festival, and the church was beautifully decorated with flowers, and I was very surprised and taken aback. I didn't realize it was harvest, and I thought that was very nice. That's about the first recollection I have of the church, I think. Well, that would have been in 1938, and you as you know, there was threats of war, which was averted for about a year by Chamberlain. And as I say, we all came here to pray for peace.
Quite a solemn occasion.
Oh, yes, it was, yes. After the war, the chancel windows were dedicated. The old ones were blown out by a flying bomb, and they were dedicated, and it was an evening service, and a dark, and Guy Botting fixed up some floodlights outside. But since the lights were run from the church, in order not to overburden the electricity, all the lights in the church were turned out. and then the lights outside were turned on. And it was most effective to see the bright lights coming through these new windows.
Gerard Sherman and two wartime memories. Many people recall the pleasures of walking to Albury Church on a Sunday morning. Elsha King was one of them.
We always used to walk down. I had a great aunt, and she used to take us with her down. We walked through the Warren. And my memories of those walks down there, one of the most vivid that I have, there had been a hard frost the previous night. And after there must have been a fire at some time in the park, because after a fire, foxgloves fill the space left by the fire. Well, I remember this morning, with frost on the foxgloves and frost, hoarfrost on the branches of the trees, and it was one of the most beautiful memories that I've ever had.
The walk completed, you were greeted at the church for many years by Mr. Puddick, the verger.
He was quite a character. Now, I can't remember his Christian name, but he also ran the club, the men's club opposite the church, you know, the working men's club there. And he was a verger and did a lot of things. But he was a great character. We all liked him very much. He used to, when he sat at the back of the church, he always said, and I think the young folk waited for it, he used to say, "Amen," very loudly. Also, my husband, late husband, was best man at a wedding 60 years ago now, this year. And he said, I was there too, you see, and he said, "Who's paying?" And I said, "Well, I suppose Jackie's," I said, "he's the best man." And he went up to Jack and said, 13 sevenpence, penny for the stamp. And I thought that was jolly cheap getting married in 1932, wasn't it, for 13 sevenpence?
Wynne Brown on Mr. Puddick, the verger. And the rectors of Albury live on in memory too. Canon Skeen, 1921-29. Philip Gray, 1930-1944. James Farquhar, 1944-48. The Reverend Singh, 1948-1959. And Stuart Orme, the longest serving of all the rectors, from 1959-1987, and famous for his scholarly and thought-provoking sermons. One of the most compelling speakers from the pulpit of Albury Church was Philip Gray's young curate from 1937-1940, the Reverend Tupper, grandson of Martin Tupper.
My husband was a natural preacher, which he'd inherited, I suppose, from his grandfather, the gift of words. He was a very excellent preacher, very sincere, had a lovely speaking voice. I think that's quite an unbiased opinion. He was also diocesan youth leader when he was here, so he was very busy. He started a youth club, which was successful, in Albury. And I did a nativity play. That was about my... my contribution, I think.
Margaret Tupper's nativity play was echoed years later in the 1970s by Mary Rose Littler Jones.
One of the things I did, and I really enjoyed, I ran the little nativity scene. It was really just a tableau for about 2 or 3 years, and we dressed the children up and arranged a crib scene. And it was fun dressing them up and making the king's prizes, you know, the frankincense and myrrh, and the dress, paint, making them up. They enjoyed it.
So where did you assemble the materials for? I mean, the clothing and the frankincense and myrrh and so on?
Mostly from the cupboards here in the house.
And then when was it acted out? Is it
usually just in the church, just at Christmas time, either before or after the carol service.
Virgin Mary.
Down the years, many Albury people have worked and cared for the church. There's the dedicated band who provide the flowers, for instance. Elsha King explains the flower rota.
We have the seasonal displays, Easter, Whitsun, Harvest Festival. Now, Harvest Festival is the crux of the whole thing. It's a festival in which we give back the fruits of our efforts. Some people do one thing, some do another. Those who love flowers do flower arranging. Those who grow fruit produce the fruit. The farmers produce the sheaves of corn, all for the Harvest Festival. Well, when you come to think of it, every week, the person who does flowers at the altar is giving back the fruits of their activities. And it's a matter of honour with us to try as much as we possibly can to do the altar flowers with flowers from our own gardens. That's not always possible. I mean, when it comes to Christmas, you don't have a great many flowers in your garden. But we do. We try to do that. And since we have a rota of flowers all the year, practically every woman who attends church has one week in which she gives back to the church her own efforts, which I think is a lovely idea.
The miracle of the flowers. There are money-raising efforts on behalf of the church too, among them a harvest luncheon hosted by Mary Rose Littler Jones, who also runs the church sale.
The sale is held in November, and there it really is a question of going round and collecting people's jumble, raffle prizes, getting the posters designed, printed or drawn by hand. People work very hard for the sale.
Yes,
they're
I'm
very
sure.
good all around. They work, put in a lot of time. People don't realise what a lot of work it is. And then at the end, it's all the clearing up, the sweeping of the floor, getting rid of the rubbish, fighting with the man who says he'll take it all away and give you £2 if you're lucky.
The church itself needs regular care and attention, and it gets it from dedicated volunteers. Kathleen Merritt, keeper of the brasses, was polishing one of the large altar candlesticks when I talked to her, and she explained how she got the job.
There was a young woman who used to come in and clean the church, and one sometimes sitting there, I would think, oh gosh, the brass doesn't look very nice. And I said to the rector, who does the brass now? And so he said, well, I'm afraid Sylvie does the cleaning, but she doesn't like cleaning brass. So I said, well, I hate to see it looking like that. I don't mind cleaning it. So he said, oh, would you, Mrs. Merritt? I said, well, yes. So since then, I've done it, you see.
And that was roughly when? I mean, how many
years?
Oh,
goodness. 11, 12 years ago, something like that, you know.
Now, by keeping them done, what is it, once a week, was
once
it?
Once a week,
once
yes.
a week.
It takes me about an hour.
Yeah.
Once a month I do the communion plate as well, and that, of course, takes me, so it's usually about an hour and a half or 2 hours that... And the flower vases on a Friday, I usually, because you can't clean them when the flowers are in them, you know. Mm. So the flower ladies usually come on a Saturday to do the flowers. So I take the flower vases out and take them in the vestry. And if any of the flowers are nice enough to be sort of used again with some fresh ones, I leave those and then throw out all the old ones.
And then there's the dust and moth that doth corrupt. That's the challenge facing another servant of Albury Church, Margaret Huffner.
I clean it, and that means clearing up, watering the flowers, hoovering. We now have, after the renovations, we have a cloakroom, and tidying up there. And I do the vestry and the choir vestry. From time to time I do things like making curtains and generally treating it like a second home, really.
How long does it take you to clean it up?
It depends. After a harvest festival, when there's old man's beard everywhere, and after Christmas, when there are holly berries everywhere, it takes probably 2 hours, but usually just over an hour. And I simply love it. But I must say the best kept part of the whole church is the belfry. It's absolutely wonderful up there. It's like a parlour. I always think that is the best spot, because I used to occasionally ring bells during the war, but really I'm a bit too old now for that.
The captain of the tower at Albury is Bob Knights. Bob, tell me first of all something about the bells themselves.
The bells, there are 6 bells here at Albury. 4 were cast in 1695 and 2 were cast in 1841 when this church was built. And the 4 original ones came from the old church in Albury Park. And 1935 they were recast, a sum of £528. And the chiming apparatus were put on as well, so another cost of £20. And they are in fact the same bells they have on them. They put the same inscriptions on them. You see on these early bells, there's William Eldridge made me, MW, 1695, and he was obviously a local founder. But we now have these 6 bells, and they're a very delightful ring of 6 bells. In fact, the tenor's quite heavy for a 6, it's 1600 weight, and the smallest bell, the treble, is 500 weight. But they've served us well. They've not been had any major work done on them, in fact, for over 50 years. They were last recast in 1935 and rehung, and since then all we've done, keeping fingers crossed, is to change the ropes and change the stays, and they go merrily on.
And occasionally change the ringers.
Occasionally change the ringers, yes. Yes, we've seen a few ringers in those days.
Before the bells were recast in 1935, they'd been silent for some years. A team of ringers had to be recruited and trained. One of them was the choir boy who'd had the honour of turning on the electricity here in the church all those years before. Now a young man, Godfrey Gillett turned his hand to bell ringing.
The rector then, Philip Gray, he must have got into touch with the top brass in the bell ringing business. In fact, it resulted in 6 or 8 of us learning to ring at Holy Trinity Church in Guildford. And the man in charge there was Alf Pulling, and he was considered to be a very eminent gentleman in bell ringing, and we really learnt to ring in there. And I always remember the man that taught me. I had the same one every time, some old ringer from Guildford. He always called me Little Un, because, as I say, I was still on the small side even for that. In fact, we stood on boxes there to ring. Anyway, we were taught to ring, and I think we done quite well. And then we used to, on a Sunday morning here, in fact, he did come to, that his Alf Pulling came out to Albury when we had ours rehung and going, because they were hung on ball bearings, very modern at that time, and they were very easy to ring. In fact, I rang the treble, which is only 200 weight, which against about 700 weight in Guildford. But over, being small, I suppose I was chosen to ring the treble, and I rang that bell.
Look, 2, treble's going, she's gone.
Three on the treble, 2 on the phone.
We ring at 10:30 every Sunday morning for the service, and we ring also for special events. We do ring court appeals for royal births and royal marriages and various functions that happen, and we ring them for in memoriam, really. We've just rung one for Leonard Cheshire, and we ring Christmas, of course, over the Christmas holiday. We ring New Year, and we ring for weddings, and we have a practice night on Monday nights, which is from 7:30 to 9, which most people come to, most of the loyal band come to anyway. And you're doing a service for the church, really. It's a very important service, I think. ringing the bells to let people know the church is there and there's a service going on or about to go on.
So the parish church of St. Peter and St. Paul, Albury, is 150 years old. Young in comparison to many churches, but still with a wonderful story to tell. I asked Dudley Gummer, our present rector, where next for Albury Church?
We want the people of Albury to know that this is their church. It's not for a select few or a favoured few. It is for all people. All people who wish to discover the fullness of life that is available to them in and through Jesus Christ, who is the window onto God. And only in and through the Christian church is that going to be possible. And we want people to feel that this is their spiritual home. And so to bring them in is one aspect. Another aspect is to build people up in the faith so that they can feel that they understand and know what it means, really, to have this fullness of life. And then to be able to go out and help others to discover what they themselves have discovered. And so this 150th anniversary of the consecration is an opportunity to say thank you very much to all those who've done what they've done over the past 150 years in the very many ways in which a church in a village is run and organized. But we have to look to the future. As it says in that musical Salad Days, if I let nostalgia blind me and begin retracing my track, I'll remind you to remind me we said we wouldn't look back. Which is another way of saying, on this 150th anniversary, hats off to the past, coats off to the future.